Hello, hello, hello. Happy Thursday to you. So, before I forget, because I always forget to tell you this, guys, log on to Facebook, go to the Insights page on Progressive Radio Network, I should say, the Progressive Radio Network page on Facebook. You can see us live streaming, video streaming, and then I realize I have to get my own show banner, like, behind me, so obviously, when you log on to Facebook and you see this beautiful studio with our beautiful guests, I didn't tell you you're going to be on TV, did I, Annie? No, I didn't. Anyway, so I was remiss in doing so. But anyway, I got it out of the way. My name's Mark Farrell. The show is Insights. Welcome to Thursday, Friday Eve. Can you believe August is here? Holy cow. Hard to fathom. You know what that means? Labor Day is right around the corner. Sad, sad thought. Anyway, I'm always digging summer. I don't care how hot it is. Bring it on. Bring it on. Hey, from the How Cool Is This file, we have so much to cover today, so I got to jump right into it. From the How Cool Is This file, a judge ordered the FAA to review airline seat size and legroom. I think he probably travels a lot. This is a federal judge down in D.C., and again on Friday, he said, listen, you guys, enough of this shrinking seat and legroom. You need to monitor this, and I think he wants to impose regulations, mandatory sizes, because if it was up to airlines, you know, they'd put us all in the dryer before we got on the airline to shrink us for a few minutes so they can get an extra 10, 15, 20 people on air. So very cool to the judge in D.C. for doing that. So later on the show, you're going to meet an incredible artist named Annie Least. I met Annie through a mutual friend who's a friend of the show, Michelle Spitz, and she is an incredibly talented artist who has a unique perspective on many levels. Number one, her artistry alone speaks volumes. But number two, how her vision is and how it plays and how it rolls out and affects and impacts her artwork is just really, really spectacular. And I wanted her to come to the show to share her story because it's really innovative. And I love meeting creative, innovative people. And not only is she a great artist, but she's an accessibility advocate, and we love those people as well. So, you know, of course, it's still summer, and so many parents just say to their kids, okay, bye-bye, all right, see you later, come back in the end of August and ship them away to sleepaway camp. I don't see how you can do that. Not judging, by the way. Just saying, you know, if you don't like your kids, it's a good thing to do, you know, if you don't love them that much because, you know, you don't have to deal with them, just ship them away for 2 months. But, you know, anyway, so my lead in here is there was a camp that I went to and made me think of it because my son goes to a day camp, like a rec camp where we live. And, you know, it's just a couple hours a day, 6-7 hours a day, has a blast, etc. But it reminded me of the one and only time I went to camp. And it was hysterical because the New Jersey Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired told me about this camp. And they're like, okay, Mark, you know, I think I was going into high school. So it was my eighth grade summer into my freshman year. And they said, listen, here's a camp. I don't know why they never told me about this for all the years that I was receiving services through them about this earlier. It would have been nice to know. Anyway, so they're like, okay, here's this camp. And it's actually for a bit of a younger group. But they will allow you to go, but age-wise, you're going to be a little bit closer to the counselors than the actual campers. And I was like, okay, cool. It's only a week. It's a sleepaway camp in North Jersey, right across the river from New York City. So I'm like, okay, so it's for blind and visually impaired campers. I'm like, well, of course, that makes sense. It's called Camp Marcella, and actually still to this day, it's called Camp Marcella. So we did a lot of cool things. And I had never experienced any form of camp before because, like many people my age, 50, you didn't go to camps. You just did your own thing. You ate breakfast. You brushed your teeth. You opened your door. And you came back in when the streetlights were on. That's pretty much it. Unless you were totally dehydrated, you were injured, or, I don't know, dazed because you were dehydrated. Something of that nature. Anyway. So here I am. I go to this camp, and I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. Oh, wow, they got a pool. They got all these activities. This is great. Counselors are pretty cool. I was digging it. So one of the first things that happened was great. We find out there's a talent show, and they're like, okay, what can you do? I'm like, I don't know. And I'm sure that happened to many, many kids. So this great, incredible, driven, and passionate music teacher taught me how to play a song on a guitar in, I think, 2 days. Okay. All right. This is be prepared to laugh because Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star is no Stairway to Heaven. You don't have to move over Jimmy Page or all the other guitar greats. Mark Farrell's not in competition with you. But I did get it, and it was kind of cool. So the last night, I got up on stage, and I took center stage. I remember they gave me a stool. It's like, it's like I had a rock show, and then I just did my a cappella song. I'm like, all right, everybody, let's slow it down. Twinkle. I didn't sing. And hit it. And I did all right. You know, I did all right. So anyway, that was kind of a cool thing. It's a great confidence builder, and it's just kind of a neat because it's all about, you know, instilling camaraderie, especially for kids with disabilities, character building, and things of that nature. A talent show, do just like that. Or the complete opposite happens. Somebody comes up and gets stage fright and blanks their pants or whatever, and, you know, in therapy for the rest of their life. And so this is kind of cool, too. They had a bowling alley. Yeah, really cool. A bowling alley. It was just one lane. So I guess on days where it was inclement because it rained one day, of course. And so we're bowling. So this is kind of really funny because here we are, a bunch of visually impaired kids and blind kids. Now, the particular week that I was there, most of the campers were blind or severely visually impaired. So I was a little bit on the better end of the spectrum in terms of sight-wise. So I won a bowling trophy. I came in first place, and I moved a couple years ago, and I have still yet to find this bowling trophy. I'm so mad at myself because it meant the world to me, and I think the score was like 120 or 130, and to me, that nowadays, if I get 120 or 30, I'm like, rock and roll, that's pretty good. So back then, but here's the kind of funny part. So they have this one-lane bowling alley. And so when the ball went down the alley, the lane, knocked over the pins, there was no mechanism, no automatic mechanism to pick up the pins. There was just people that were sitting on top of like a padded surface. And so once everything calmed down, the pin stopped, you know, banging around and the ball came to a halt, they would stop and jump down just a couple feet. And these are the same kids that are my fellow campers that are blind or visually impaired. So we're all trying to set up the bowling pins. And they're marked. And it's hysterical because, first of all, it's kind of the confines are tight, you know. So here we are trying to put up these pins. You know, you got to try to put them up steady. So that was really, really something I will never, ever forget. And that's what camp is all about, right? The fun times. I mean, that's what they, oh, God, what was that movie called? Meatballs. Wasn't that the best camp movie that depicted everything? Bill Murray? If you have never seen Meatballs, the original one is very, very good. And my last and final hysterical memory of being at sleepaway camp was one night, I think the counselors came up to me and said, Mark, I want you to be the ringleader here and orchestrate this. And I'm like, what? They're like, well, this is something we do with every new set of campers every week. And since your eyes are a little bit better, I want you to be the leader. I'm like, okay, what are we gonna do? He's like, all right, well, he tells me what to do, and this is what we do. So he wakes me up at a certain time. I don't know what time it was, maybe 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I tell everybody, I wake them up and I say, grab your pillow. And I don't really remember how many people were in this cabin. I'd say, I don't know, 10, 15 campers. So I wake everybody up and everyone's really stoked. And I'm like, and I go to turn a light on and I turn a light on and I realize, oh, okay, yeah, all right. Well, it's late and I'm squinting and it's too bright for me. And don't think about anything else. And so then I'm like, all right, here's what we're going to do, guys. We're going to go to the cabin next door and we're going to beat the heck out of them with pillows. You know, good old clean fun. So that's what we do. So I kind of like tether everyone together. Like everyone either hold on to the pillow in front of you or the pillow in back of you. So we start, you know, weaving our way to the cabin next door. So we go in, I'm like, all right, shh, we're hunting wabbit. You got to be quiet, all right? I open the door, you know, of course, the traditional screen door. You know, you hear that screen door opening, the spring. And we get in there, I'm like, shh, they're like, go. I'm no, hold on, I got to find the light. They're like, we don't need the light. I'm like, oh, you're right. And I just push him in there and they go hog wild. I'm like swinging anything. And it was hysterical. I mean, pillows were flying everywhere. People in the same like group, camping groups were hitting each other. It didn't matter. It was just free flow fun. And it was hysterical. And I thought of that the other day because I was reading an article in the New York Times about sleepaway camps. And first of all, how pricey they are. There's a camp in my town that's not even a sleepaway camp that costs $10,000. $10,000. I don't live in an affluent town for the summer. 10 grand. Oh, I'm sorry. It includes bus service to and from. It'll pick you up. Wow. So we've grown up, you know, quite differently and come a long way, I guess, from the Camp Marcellus in the world. But those are some great memories. It's about 10 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock in New York City. My name is Mark Frow. The show is Insight. Always love your feedback. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Streaming live on Facebook. Go to Progressive Radio Network on Facebook and check out yours truly with a large print, the large font. I'm so bummed. I've ordered new printer cartridges the other day that were $30 less on Amazon versus Staples. $30. I was like, are you kidding me? This can't be the truth. Oh, my God. Anyway, they were supposed to arrive yesterday. They didn't arrive. So here I am, handwriting, reading my own handwriting. I'll get through. I'll muddle through. Got to talk about something that really struck me over the weekend. It was just incredibly sad. I was just crestfallen when I read about this story. And I'm sorry to bring you sad news about this story such of this nature. But you're going to understand why. Because the end result is people just need to reach out and ask for help. And if you recognize somebody in turmoil, man, just intervene and say, listen, is there something, you know, do it tactfully and privately, but you'll understand when I tell you the story. And maybe you read about this, but Dr. Glenn Scarpelli is a 53-year-old doctor living in New York City with his wife, chiropractor. His wife, Patricia, and he jumped from their building Sunday morning, I believe, 5:40 a.m. or Saturday morning, I'm not sure, holding hands, two kids. And apparently they left suicide notes in plastic baggies, each one of them, because of obviously they were worried about it not being legible after their act. And apparently the evidence surfaced that, yes, in the notes they said they're in financial turmoil. But, I mean, I think it was under $50K, well under $100K that they owed. So, I mean, we probably all know people. Whether we actually know their financial debt, because I know a lot of people carry debt from month to month, that probably own, I know actually one of my friends that probably owns $30K on his credit card. But the reality is, I mean, you claim bankruptcy, there are answers. There are people, there are other outlets, there are other ways to get through just tumultuous times. I mean, I understand mental illness and depression and how people's scope in life can get so narrowed. But just when I read this story, that the fact that they left behind a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old. Now, how scarred are these kids and what kind of message do you leave behind for your children about resiliency and reaching out for help? It's just really sad. And here's the really surprising part is that this guy, Glenn Scarpelli, Dr. Scarpelli, played an invaluable, instrumental role post 9/11. He was down there helping out all the responders, all the volunteers. I think he brought a chiropractic table, one of those portable ones, was helping people out for weeks, volunteering. He loved philanthropic, giving back acts. He was very involved. He and his wife seemed extremely, extremely giving. And believe me, as you know, well-informed, and if you don't know, chances are, you know, you could experience one bout, at least stats show, one bout of mental illness in your lifetime. So if we have some pre-existing education, some knowledge of what to do, what to expect if something, an onset of mental illness, depression, bipolar disorder, I mean, you know, many, many aspects to it, continues or happens, the onset, then you know, yes, you can still be surprised, but just know that suicide is not the answer. It just continues just to rock my world. And obviously, you know, I've been touched by it. I lost my brother to it. And it's just so frustrating to know that so many people, whether it's due to embarrassment, professionally, family-wise, a sign of weakness, all those taboos that are being reduced, they are shrinking, but they still are omnipresent. But F them. Take care of yourself. Do whatever you need to do, especially for your children. I know so many people that are parents that have lost their children, their offspring, and they either didn't know about it or they did their best because they didn't have all the full information, etc. But we just have to know for ourselves that there's help out there, and chances are, you know, you will definitely get healthier. And I'm surprised, actually, and I don't mean to minimize, or I'm not sure if minimize is the correct term, but a doctor. I know he's a doctor of chiropractics. I can't say that word. Chiropractic doctor. You know, obviously is not a mental health doctor, not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, doesn't have expertise. But I'm certainly he took psychology courses in school. And I'm sure a man of 53 years of age has known someone who's gone through depression or some sort of mental illness issues. But it's just kind of amazing when I think about this, especially the fact that both of them, husband and wife, are on the same page. I find that remarkable that they could both be so desperate. And not one of them could say, you know what? Yeah, we're in a bad place, but it's going to get better. I can borrow money. We could do this. We can close your business. We can start a new profession. Whatever the case may be, if their kids are in private school, we can put them in public school for a year. We can move out of the city. I mean, there's so many different options. And I understand it. Again, the blinders are on when you're depressed, but it's just so hard to fathom that two people could be on the exact same page, husband and wife, mother and father. That just kind of rocks my world. Anyway, so please, if you know anybody who's struggling, even if you suspect so, you know, talk to somebody else and get some advice maybe on how to approach somebody, or read up on it, or just try not to let it go, especially, you know, a good friend of your life. Maybe it's a time to say this. Maybe this is a good idea. Tell anybody in your life, listen, if you ever think that I'm going through a hard time, don't ever ask me if I'm just okay. Like, hey, how you doing? How's the weather? Are you okay? Yeah, great. Because that's just a creature of habit statement question. You don't really expect somebody to say, I'm having a really rough day because X, Y, and Z. But put it out there to people. Say, listen, if you ever think that I'm going through a crisis, and maybe you don't even think I'm aware of it, please, please be a friend, a big brother or a big sister or whatever the case may be, husband, wife, cousin, uncle, stranger, colleague, professional acquaintance, whatever. Just say, hey, is everything okay? I just noticed, you know, things are a little bit different. And maybe you don't have to certainly open up candidly to me, but just want to let you know that, and just maybe have an agreement with some people that you can check in. It's just like we have an agreement with my siblings and I, like, if, when we get too old, you know, just say, listen, well, I'm taking your driver's license away and that's it, because we're not going to end up like our parents. On that note, this is a great segue. So, Jimmy Buffett. All right. You know, you either love him or hate him. Not him himself, but his music, because his music is just not my, I don't know, it's just not my cup of tea. I'm not a parrot head. And parrot heads, of course, are the devout fans of Jimmy Buffett. But I do really like his lifestyle, and I love his books. If you haven't read his books, I'd say pick them up, because I devour them. I really like him. I probably would not ever go to a concert of his unless I got free tickets. Again, because, you know, Margaritaville, who doesn't love it, you know, but that's about it. I'm not going to go see somebody, especially I'd be the only one in the audience who's not putting a fin. So people put their hands above their heads, because they're Finns, and that's one of their song, Finns, and they have this whole thing, like, I guess it's like the equivalent of like doing a YMCA. I don't know. I've never been. So anyway, so here I am picturing this retirement community because Jimmy Buffett wants to open Margaritaville retirement communities. And I think it's a friggin' brilliant idea. So, but can you see this? Like all these like scooters running around with like Jimmy Buffett flags, margarita flags, or fins? So, of course, it got me thinking. All his hot top songs, his really popular songs, okay? Wasting Away in Margaritaville, Margaritaville tune. I think the tune should have to be renamed Wasting Away Again in My Depends. Right? Makes sense. So, like, he's going to have to, like, this is a great way to reinvent himself. Like, he can have new versions of his songs that can be played at these retirement communities. Instead of a cheeseburger in paradise, how about tapioca pudding in paradise? How about Come Monday, another one of his favorites for his fans? Come Change Me. And, of course, finally but not last, Fins. You know, Fins in the Air, and that's another one of his popular songs. It'll be dentures. And so instead of putting your hand or fin in the air, you can just take out your teeth and wave them like nobody cares. What do you say? I think it's a great, I think it's something that really can take off because Jimmy Buffett, I mean, he is just like a hot commodity. His brand is just unbelievable. Chances are, wherever you flew recently, if it's not a tiny airport, he had a Margaritaville restaurant. Never gone in one, but I'm sure it's just like all the others, TGI Fries, etc. You know, food that's just kind of rebranded and repackaged in terms of for Jimmy Buffett. But that's pretty cool, right? I mean, go Jimmy. Why not? This is the land of the free and opportunity. And if you can make it work, why not? So I had a great privilege a couple weeks ago to meet an artist. And anytime I meet an artist, whether it's a person who's a musical artist, a musician, a poet, someone who's incredibly gifted with brushes or pens or pencils, I just am always riveted by their craft. And that my meeting with Annie Leese was no different. And I wanted to bring her to the show because not only is she an incredible artist, but she does it in her own way, through her eyes that are not 2020 like mine or like many people's. Annie Leese, disability advocate and artist, welcome to the show. And slide on up to that microphone, my dear. You don't need headphones right now.
All right.
Just talk back to me.
Okay. Hi.
It's radio. We need to hear you.
It's radio.
Come on a little closer to the microphone. Don't be shy.
All right.
There you go. There you go. How are you?
I'm well, Mark. How are you?
Now, what a stereotypical thing. An artist living in Brooklyn.
Well, technically Queens.
Oh, Queens. Oh, okay. Okay. Your studio is?
In Queens.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Go Ridgewood.
Ridgewood.
Shout out
okay.
To Ridgewood, yeah.
So you started painting at a very, very early age. As a matter of fact, there was a phone call that was made to your house. And when you were in what grade?
I was in kindergarten.
Kindergarten. I mean, how many kids have their teachers call their parents at home to talk about a painting? Please fill us in.
Well, I technically, it wasn't a painting. I didn't really get into painting until I was a little bit older. But my first or second day of kindergarten, I had always drawn. I had always had crayons and magic markers and done all kinds of things. Thank you. Done all kinds of things artistically, you know, and gone through the sketch pads and loved going to the art supply stores. But then I went to kindergarten and, you know, for some reason that I really do not understand to this day, I drew a picture of a porcupine. And in black magic marker, and it's just a side view of this porcupine. He's got a big smile on his face, and
like all
porcupines, of course. And and my teacher, you know, put one of those smiley face stamps on the corner. It says "Nice work" or something like that.
That confirmed your work.
Exactly.
Yay!
Exactly. You know, and I'm happy, and I go home, and turns out the teacher called my mom and I called my parents and said, you know, so did your daughter have a porcupine? Has she seen one recently?
Every cartoon has a porcupine.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, maybe so. I don't remember exactly why I drew the porcupine, but the teacher was very impressed with not so much the porcupine itself, but with how I drew it. And actually, the porcupine is still with us. Porcupines have since been sort of an important personal icon for me, but the porcupine itself is still with us. When I got my master's in fine arts and graduated for a graduation gift for me, my parents found that old porcupine and got it framed, and so it hangs in my apartment next to my diploma. So.
I think that's good branding for you.
I love the porcupine. So,
well, it's an interesting story you had shared with me that when you were doing, I believe, is your master's in fine arts, that you were in a class, and for a bit of a time that you kind of felt like you were lost as an artist. You didn't know your real calling, what avenue. And one person to your left or right was in their artistry. He or she was coming out of the closet. They were freeing themselves. And then I believe a female student of yours was her abuse that she was experiencing was coming out in her artwork. And you felt a little bit like you didn't have a direction.
Yeah, and that was in college when we were sort of, I had really discovered oil painting and had gotten a lot of the skills, the technical skills, but we were sort of transitioning into more conceptual realms of what our art was going to be and who we were going to be as artists. And you're right, I felt like, you know, I had a great childhood. I had incredibly supportive family, great friends, did well in school, loved college, you know, felt like I was kind of a middle-class white girl in jeans and flannels and didn't really have much to say.
Newsflash, you still are.
Yes, I am.
Minus the flannels.
Minus the flannels,
Maybe in the studio, though.
Yeah, the flannel will come out. The
Good.
Flannel comes
rock,
out a little bit
rock
in the studio.
Rock the flannel.
I started painting the most meaningless things that I could think of, which at the time were bars and fraternity parties and social gatherings.
I'm sorry, those are meaningless?
Well,
bars have a lot of depth to me.
Well, it turns out they had a lot of depth for me too. But at the time, I felt like I was painting frivolity. Kind of in a rebellious sort of way.
Understandable.
Yeah. But it turns out that they did mean something to me. I realized relatively rapidly that I was interested in those places because they were interesting socially. They were, you know, you're physically close to a lot of people, but you may not be psychologically or emotionally close to them. And a lot of decisions are made based on appearance, but at the same time, they're usually lit in very strange ways, or the architecture is really weird, or they're very dark. So they were interesting visually to me, too. And in some ways, one sort of theme that I think has pervaded my whole art career is that I tend to paint things that are a little bit challenging to me in real life. And I think maybe painting is kind of my way to move through space or move in interesting social situations that I don't do as smoothly in real life because of my vision.
Any lice? Oh, it is vision-based. It's not a skill base.
In terms of
challenging. You said the word challenging.
Yeah. I think a lot of it comes from my vision. I do have limited vision. And
so right now you're legally blind.
Yes.
Your right eye, you have no vision.
No vision in my right.
Left eye is 2400 or worse.
Something like that. Yep. And it's not a particular illness or syndrome. It's just...
it is a syndrome. It's called bad eye syndrome.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's called I'm really, really nearsighted.
I think MD.com has something on there like that. You know, you can find whatever you want to name something, right?
Call it the Annie Least syndrome.
There you go. Oh, my God. That's great. Yeah. The porcupine syndrome.
There you go. Porcupine.
So this actually happened when you were young. You were born. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Born. And it's a rare condition and it doesn't really have a name.
Does it really? It doesn't have a name. It's just a collection of symptoms. It's, you know, I've always been legally blind. I always used. I was born with vision in both of my eyes, but I always used one eye at a time. So I never had the binocular stereo vision that
wouldn't that be nice?
A lot of people, who knows? I have no idea. I think it actually makes me a better painter that I don't have it. Because
interesting,
painting is about putting the three-dimensional world on a two-dimensional in a two-dimensional plane.
Wow!
And so I've got the advantage of already seeing in two dimensions.
Wow,
so
I never thought of it in that
membership
aspect.
Has its privileges.
That's great. Yeah, it does. Well, you know, with me, I can identify not as a painter, but a person with a right eye that's much stronger than my left eye. My left eye is 2400 or worse. Mm-hmm. So I have monovision as well. Mm-hmm. And I imagine like reading. I couldn't imagine reading with two eyes. It must be. I mean, it's a very, very foreign concept.
I really can't conceptualize it because to me, my world, because the world is three-dimensional, that's, you know, that's my three-dimensional. But apparently it's I think it must be pretty intense, but I guess if you're used to it.
Yes. Well, I imagine your hearing, like mine, is impeccable.
What?
Did you do that on purpose?
I totally did.
Your facial reaction was so good, I actually believed you for a half a second.
That's
well, here's
Dad.
The thing that really rocks my world is that being a very sensitive auditory person and being in radio for 18, 19 years, especially in a creative behind-the-scenes person where audio is my love and first love and passion, mm-hmm. is that if I don't hear something right, it totally rocks my world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So visually, obviously, I was born this way as well. So can you imagine the parallel of the hearing because it's dual? Mm-hmm. Both your
Yeah. It's very interesting. And I completely get what you mean when you can't hear well. It sort of rocks your mind, rocks your world, because I know, and this is what makes perception and sort of the combination of the senses so interesting to me and how the brain works, because I've actually found myself, without thinking about it, if I'm walking down a sidewalk that I know well and there's construction happening and it's really loud, I actually, unbidden once, had the thought, I cannot see very well because it's so loud out here. And I hadn't ever really thought
wow.
about how much of my sort of navigation and perspective on the world was seamlessly linked.
How pervasive
between,
it is.
You know, not just hearing, but also touch and smell and you know, all of the other senses kind of working together. So I found that really fascinating.
Jackhammers can do that, I think.
They can. They can.
So you started out at a very early age. You got a lot of awards and accolades. So that must have fueled you. And when you were telling me that you were so supported in school, you could see the chalkboards up to a certain point and you could read, and you had a voracious appetite for reading, and you used to have black nose, right?
Yes,
from keeping those books
nose.
So close.
I had the black nose. From
that is so great
books.
Because we're not that far apart in age. Like I'm 30 and what, you're like 22? No, I wish.
Yes, exactly.
So, but the difference is extreme, because I didn't have any assistive technology whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So my education was just deplorable. I mean, I couldn't see chalkboards, took me longer to read. Mm-hmm. Hence, I was always behind, never caught up, had to get accepted into college on a probationary status. Mm-hmm. Horrific, horrific SAT scores, PSATs, even worse, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were even better. I don't know, because the SATs were so bad that how could they even be worse? But it's so... made me so happy to hear that your educational process was so spot on and happy and effective, of course.
I was really lucky. I was, it's a lot of different factors. I was put in what they called back then a mainstream classroom. Hmm. So I never actually met anyone else who had a serious, I never had a relationship with anyone else or a friendship with anyone else who had a severe visual impairment, and probably until my 30s. And so I was just sort of always kind of part of the general crowd. And I had incredibly supportive parents who told me I could do whatever I wanted to do as long as it wasn't behind the wheel of a car. And they completely supported my interest in art. They completely supported my interest in school. I was a big, giant nerd, so that also probably played a role. I remember being a little kid and literally getting up and standing next to the blackboard, and the teachers would let me do that so I could read what was on the blackboard and watch them writing. And when I was 9, I got a monocular, fourth grade, a monocular, which is essentially like half a pair of binoculars, which sort of made a world of difference in terms of reading the chalkboard and reading the overhead projectors. You know, we didn't have computers as much then. We didn't have tablets. We didn't have this kind of assistive technology. But yeah, I was able to read by holding things very close, and I was really excited about school. So supportive parents, supportive teachers.
Fantastic.
Like a totally nerdy drive.
Did you receive any services from the North Carolina Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired?
I did. I mean, we touched base with them every year or so. For a while, I got large print books, which actually I found a lot more cumbersome and not worth the difference that they made for me. Because they were several volumes and each page folded out. And so if you wanted to flip pages, you had to fold a page out and then fold it back in and then flip again and fold the page out.
A lot of trees came down for that page.
Yeah, they did. They did. And you know, it was all with good intentions.
Sure.
And, you know, but it was just, for me, I made the decision that it wasn't as, you know, I would rather sort of, I don't know.
Grunt it out?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Kind of plow my way through the regular print.
And well, you certainly did. I mean, you ended up being valedictorian of your class.
I was.
Congratulations.
Valedictorian of my high school. Thank you. Hopefully not my peak of life.
But it was a pretty
exciting moment.
So you shared an interesting story with me that one day you're preparing for a test and something happened with your eye. Was it your lens?
No, that this was in college and I was trying to get ready for class in a dark room, not wake up my roommate. And of course, our room was a disaster, as most college kids' dorm rooms are. And I bent over to pick something up and kind of rammed my face with a drying rack, which sounds horrifying, and it wasn't much fun. But remember, by that time, I only had vision in one eye. I lost the vision in my right eye when I was 12, and by that time, I was using my left eye exclusively. And so I didn't do any serious damage to it, but I gave myself a little bit of a shiner on my left eye, which meant I couldn't really study for my test. And my professor's hands were tied. He wasn't able to postpone the test for me more than a couple days. And so at that point, I actually went to Wake Forest University, which was in my hometown. And at that point, my parents living in the same town became very handy because my mom came, got my psychology book, and put all of the chapters on tape. And it was so
That's
great.
That's love.
And it was so, my parents are both so amazing.
That's incredible.
But, mom read everything, and that became such an efficient way for me to work.
Is that the first time you heard of books on tape?
Not really. I guess I had done, played a couple of them through sort of the Library of Congress service, but I hadn't really gotten into audiobooks a lot. My parents read to me a fair bit. When I was recovering from surgery when I was 12 and I lost the vision in my right eye, we went through the entire collection of stories about Sherlock Holmes together. You know, so I had that experience, but had never occurred to me to use it for school. And from that was my first semester freshman year. And from then on, all the way through grad school, my mom put all of my textbooks, including such savory subjects as deviant behavior and art criticism and various other things.
Very eye-opening, riveting topics.
She put them on cassette for me.
God bless her.
Yeah.
She's a saint.
She is a saint. Both my parents are amazing, so I was very lucky.
This show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. My guest is Annie Liest. Annie Liest is an artist and disability advocate. And tell me about that surgery. And you came out of it, obviously, with only vision in one eye. Was that something that was very difficult to deal with?
You know, yes and no. I mean, it was a difficult period. You know, I was 12 years old. I had three surgeries. I had my retina in my right eye detached spontaneously. And a lot of people hear about that either through diabetes. It's a common thing that happens with diabetics. Or it's also a common thing that sometimes happens with boxers. They get punched too hard.
Sure, blunt force.
Right, exactly. And I'm neither of those. So, in spite of my muscles, you know, it just one day started spontaneously to detach. And I have one of my many symptoms is that my retinas are a little bit malformed. They're very fragile and kind of wrinkly. They're not smooth like most people's retinas. And it just sort of started coming off the back of the wall of my right eye. And so, I'm in the middle of sixth grade. I had to, you know, take a couple months off school. I had three surgeries, two in North Carolina and one in Philadelphia, just trying to do the best that, you know, the best that we could, get me the best care. And it was unfortunately not successful. So I did lose the vision in my right eye. But
was that traumatic?
It was. On the one hand, it was challenging. Because my right eye was my better eye. On the other hand, it was only better by a little bit than my left eye. And I was already only using one eye at a time. So I just sort of the left eye had to step up. So
you kind of alluded to this before. Was it easier to you to focus then with just one eye?
Not really.
Or
there wasn't really much of a difference. It was just sort of a shift.
But with one eye, post-surgery, did you realize, okay, well, the upside is that there's no competition here.
Right.
Well, I don't have to lean left or right to find out which one's better. Now I just obviously have the left eye.
Exactly. And you know, I will say one consequence of it is, as was dramatically illustrated by the incident with the drying rack in college is that not only did that moment sort of represent the time when my mom started putting books on tape for me and then I got really hooked on audiobooks, but that moment also represented the time when I started wearing glasses, which these I wear glasses to this day. They have no prescription. They are purely for protection because for me, especially as an artist, it's really important to protect what I have.
And very fashion forward, may I say.
I do what I can.
These are off the rack at Duane Reade, and they cost $18 and are 3.5 power.
Well, there
I can
you go.
Throw them against the wall. And I've had these things for like 6 months. I cannot break them. It's great.
That's amazing. I'm very hard on glasses. So
yeah,
I'm
aren't
kind
we
of
all?
Impressed
aren't
that these have lasted so long. But yeah, it was a good decision because now if something is coming at me, if I have my glasses on, even if I don't see it coming, it doesn't do any damage.
So decision-wise, your professional trajectory with your undergrad, obviously you knew you wanted and had serious interest in arts. Mm-hmm. You had a dual major, I believe, in math as well,
yep.
Art, and then you went for your master's. But was there any doubt in your mind? Sounds like your parents supported you no matter what, but is there any little voice in the back of Annie Lisa's mind that said, you know what, maybe I'm not going into the right field with a visual impairment?
Ooh, you know, it's funny, for so many years, I really sort of kept them in separate boxes. My visual impairment and my art were completely separate to me. Even after I went through college and was painting these sort of social scenes and these scenes with unusual lighting, and that kind of broadened into urban scenes and street scenes and sort of paintings based on the perspective of a pedestrian. Even as I started moving in that direction, I still sort of felt like the two were not related, which sounds very silly now because they're obviously quite related.
But sure.
But, you know, it was never an issue for me in terms of choosing my field. I think every artist has moments where they're like, gosh, am I really doing the right thing here? Am I totally crazy to be an artist? Because it's not easy to be an artist, especially if you're trying to make it your career. Any type of creative career can be challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. It's even probably more difficult than broadcasting. I mean, obviously, the entertainment field is just flooded, and the competition and making it. And the same thing with being an artist. Obviously, flooded with competition, and also you could be a brilliant artist, but just obviously getting recognized in that capacity. Obviously, you may have a little bit more of an opportunity, but also having a mentor was very, very important for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously someone who played a very pivotal part in your life because they recommended that, you know what, after your BS, your college education, take a year off, feel it out, see what you like. Don't rush right into your master's program for fine arts, which you did. Took a year off and went to Rutgers.
I took more than a year off. Yeah.
More than a year. Rock and roll and went to Ireland and where else?
I spent a year in Ireland as a Rotary Scholar at Trinity College in Dublin. You're right. My painting professor in college, Paige, said it's best advice I've ever gotten, and I would give it to people, to young artists all the time, is take some time away, make sure this is what you really want to do, because you want to be mentally ready for graduate school. And so I was in Ireland for a year. I worked in Washington, D.C. for 3 years at the National Gallery, which was an amazing job. And
so that was your first professional job?
My first professional job was actually working part-time for an insurance salesman several hours a week.
In your field, I should say.
But yes, but my first professional job in sort of the arts area was, and in a museum, was at the National
Gallery.
Did
that validate your decision?
That you're
in the right field?
More that the thing that validated my decision more is that with a full-time job, I was still finding ways to go to my studio, which was in a relatively scary neighborhood, and make paintings. And I think that's what validated it. The fact that I was still making it work even while managing a full-time job, that is what made me realize that, yes, this was my profession, and this is what I want to do.
Now, as an artist, I mean, there are a lot of artists that are self-taught, don't have any formal education. Was there any side of you that said, you know, I really don't need to go for a master's program in fine arts? You know, I'm pretty gifted and talented, and I can just, you know, evolve myself.
No, not really. I mean, I looked at that as a possibility mm-hmm. because obviously graduate school is a commitment and it's a financial commitment and it's a time commitment. It's time away from working. Grad school is, especially in the arts, is very demanding. And so, of course, I considered all sides of it. But I pretty much knew that that was something that was going to be important to me, not because I necessarily wanted to be. A lot of people go to grad school to get their master's so they can teach at the college level, and that was not something that particularly interested me at the time. But I wanted to go for a little bit of an understanding of what being a professional artist in the real world was. I wanted to go to sort of, I'm not saying I went to graduate school to network, but I wanted to be around other artists who were as serious and working in as rigorous a way as I wanted to. So
I think that opens your eyes. I mean, the influences, no matter what kind of education you're around, I mean, these people are people who are decision makers and open-minded. What's the word I'm looking for? Organic. I mean, the ideas are fresh and the mm-hmm. energy and the synergy is mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And of course, in your field, that's great.
It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. And I met some really wonderful people who I'm still connected with. So,
and then you also, I have been involved for many, many years with an organization called
Art Beyond Sight.
Yeah. Art Beyond mm-hmm. Sight. And mm-hmm. go ahead, please.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I worked with them for about 3 years. After graduate school and after several years of, I dabbled in a lot of freelance careers. I worked for an artist doing administrative support and bookkeeping for him. I another amazing artist, a mentor of mine, Steve Ellis. And I worked for, I did freelance database development. There's the math and the problem solving coming back uh-huh. for you.
So your right side of your brain is just as incredible as your left side.
Maybe. Who knows? Or just as crazy. So
I'll be sending you my taxes the first of the year.
No, thanks. And I did a number of other freelance things along those lines. And then after a while, we moved up to Boston for a few years. And I started a retail job, but I also got involved at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And that's where I met a woman named Hannah Goodwin, who has become a mentor of mine, who worked in accessibility, in museum accessibility. And she kindly allowed me to basically follow her around for a couple years as a volunteer and as sort of an unofficial intern and learn a lot about that field. It has something, and this was in my mid to late 30s, so it's something I came to kind of late in terms of thinking about how much art and museums meant to me.
Sure.
And then sort of starting to kind of link my art and my disability and my my vision and my experience of culture and starting to really realize that other people with disabilities were not having some of those same experiences or felt like there was nothing in the arts and culture for them.
Because of their limitations, sure.
Because of their limitations. And
I mean, I felt that way.
Yeah, it still blows my mind. And I still meet people today, even in New York, in a city that has actually quite a number of opportunities for at museums in particular. That's my particular area of expertise and experience. But at museums, there's tons of opportunities for people with disabilities, whether they be programs or staff who are just really great and open and welcoming. Or exhibitions that are made much more sort of multi-sensory and engaging of all kinds of people. But I still meet people who say, well, I don't go to museums. There's nothing there for me. I don't go to Broadway shows. I wouldn't understand it.
Audio descriptions.
Yes, exactly.
There's so many different things. And hence your position with the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been lucky to work since I moved back to New York. I've been lucky to work at a couple different places. Art Beyond Sight is one of them. It's a nonprofit that tries to make art and culture more accessible to people with all kinds of disabilities, even though their origins are making visual art accessible to people who are blind or have low vision. And then at the Met, actually, I have become a contractual educator, and I work teaching a class. I've done some other things, other programs as well, but the main program that I work in is called Seeing Through Drawing. And it's a program that is an art-making class designed for people who are blind or have low vision. And it's actually been going for 10 or 11 years. And I've just become involved. There's a team of four of us who teach it together, including the two, the women who sort of founded it and sort of shaped it for so many years. And there's a team of four of us that teach it together. Two of us have visual impairments. So it's, and we're both artists. So it's actually very...
And what's the skill set to the attendees, the students that are, can it be range from complete novice?
Anything. You know, we have some people who, and this always makes me a little sad. They're the people who say, well, I used to be an artist and then I lost my vision.
Yeah.
That makes me want to jump up and down and go, you're still an artist.
Yeah, of course, everybody is in their own right. Well, how liberating it is for these people to come to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I'm not sure if it's actually hosted there and just be able to do something for the first time or to pick up a pencil or a brush or a piece of chalk and just to be able to do that. That's incredible. Good for you.
And we have people who have been coming for years and years and years. And then there are some people, we get new people every year, which has been great. And we use a lot of techniques. And again, I can't take credit for most of the techniques because I'm fairly new to the program. I've been doing it for a couple years now. But, you know, we use a lot of different techniques and materials. We use tactile materials. We use sound. We use, you know, but a lot of it is just charcoal on paper. And, you know, people can understand the lines that they're making and experience things through description. We describe a lot of artwork and they draw to that. Or, you know, they can, we sometimes have other ways, tactile, people can draw from touching something. So there are a lot of ways for people to engage with the art objects at the Met and then create their own art out of it.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And Annie, at least there was another program that you were involved in not too long ago, correct, with disabilities? Mm-hmm. Something we were supposed to talk about. Something we were supposed to talk about before the show.
Right,
we both forgot.
Yes. There have been a couple things in recent years. I mean, last summer, a colleague of mine from the museum and I did our own independent version of the drawing program in Italy, which we called Drawing as Seeing, which was amazing. We're hoping to bring it back next year in Siena. So that
Fantastic.
Was a 2-week course. And
wow.
People with vision loss and without vision loss were invited to join. And we just used a lot of multi-sensory drawing techniques.
Did you have any time yourself there to feel the influence and to put it to work for yourself
on
canvas? I
had plenty of time to eat lots of pasta.
Oh, good.
We were working, Pamela Lawton and I, as my colleague, we were working very, very hard most of the time we were there.
But I'm sure you're influenced in certain capacities.
Mm-hmm, sure. And it was amazing. And Italy's a wonderful place.
So describe some of your art because, you know, you mentioned it before, it's very urban, there's perspectives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the paintings, first of all, I wouldn't just say this because you're a guest on the show. Mm-hmm. Your paintings are very magical and they draw you in because you almost feel like you're a voyeur, like looking in or onto something. And it's the first thing besides that I felt was kind of like really like perplexed because I'm like, here's a woman who's visually impaired, but a lot of your paintings are scenes that I would think that would be difficult for you to navigate and or absorb. But certainly, I mean, you know what public settings are, what people are doing, human nature, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I find that very a great compliment to each other.
Thank you. And it's interesting that you got that voyeurism a little bit. You know, I don't think about voyeurism specifically, but I do.
Only think, when you're looking in your neighbor's window.
Right, there you go. I do not do that.
Not that neighbor.
Let's be clear. When I was in grad school, we had to write a thesis, and I did a lot of reading. And one of the things that I came across was a writer called Baudelaire, who wrote a lot about in the late 1800s about an archetypical character called the flaneur, which is FLANEUR, and I think there's an accent in there somewhere. But the flaneur is this character sort of commonly known, you know, maybe as the dandy. And this is not totally nerdy. I'm getting somewhere with this. But this character was a man of privilege who could walk anywhere in the city. This was when cities were really blooming, especially Paris. And the man could walk anywhere. This Flaneur character could walk anywhere in the city. He could observe. He could observe the everyday life. He could observe the crowds. He could observe how people moved through these newly blooming, growing cities and these new crowds of people. But the big thing about him is he was in the crowd, but not necessarily of the crowd. And that sort of idea of being among people, but not necessarily of them, is, I think, something that exists in my paintings. I used to paint a lot more crowd scenes than I do now, but there's still this air of being moving through the space, but not, I think there's a little bit of distance from it. You know, on the one hand, I'm immersed in it, but on the other hand, I'm not as much a part of it. And, you know, I haven't thought a lot of this through, but I think probably my vision plays a role in that sort of feeling of separation a little bit.
And or the interpretation of it.
Exactly, yeah.
I like it. It's a nice perspective. Mm-hmm. And of course, you get commissioned. Your artwork is in art museums in North Carolina, correct?
It's not in any museums in North Carolina, but I'm in a number of different public and private collections. I'm in a couple of collections at various universities. I've been fortunate enough to, you know, through word of mouth and through people seeing my work, you know, sell pieces here and there. I have a couple galleries, in one in Knoxville and one in Charlotte. I have a solo show coming up in the Charlotte Gallery this fall. I was just in an amazing group show, actually, that is the first show I've been involved in that specifically relates to disability, with several really wonderful artists who either have disabilities or make artwork about disabilities. This was in Brooklyn. The show was called DIS, and it was
D-I-S.
D-I-S, oh yes. Because we were sort of trying to conceptually turn that DIS around.
Sure. Love it.
The DIS.
Double entendre,
disability.
Sure, yeah.
Exactly.
Love it.
But it was a culmination of this program that actually Art Beyond Sight ran, that I was the project lead for also at the time, that was called the Art and Disability Institute.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So your artwork is online, a lot of it. It's for purchase. If people want to find out more information, it's annieleist.com. That's A-N-N-I-E. Of course, Annie's not too hard to spell. Yeah. It's L-E-I-S-T.com. So Annie, if you were to do it all over again, what would you do? Would you be a DJ? Because I know you have a passion for music. I know you do.
I do have a passion for music.
Okay. Well, we have to wrap up the show here, and before we do that, we're just going to let you know, think about this. Depeche Mode, okay? You're going to be taking us out. Policy of Truth, think of what you want to say here. I'm going to say a few words, and you're going to take the show out. Again, thank you for your time and energy, and for proving to people that, you know, it doesn't matter what your limitation is in life. If you want to do something, you can be successful through hard work and determination.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
you.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this, and supportive friends and family and loved ones too.
Yeah. Gary Noah's next, and of course the show is possible. Couldn't be possible without the help of Kelsey. I'm sorry. Why am I calling you Casey today, Kelsey? And our program director extraordinaire. Okay. Here we are.
All right.
Okay. Hit that music.
Thank you, Mark Farrell.
You're going to take us out.
And taking us out today, we have Depeche Mode, Policy of Truth, from one of their all-time great albums, Violator. They're still making music, but this is still one of their best. Thank you, Mark, for having me, and y'all have a great day in New York.
Oh, my God, you rocked it out. And speaking of New York, they're coming to New York in the fall.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, do you have your tickets?
Not yet.
All right. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com, and it is all about the policy of truth. Have a great day!